together with Newton's gravitational. And you can actually, if you can figure out the periodicity of two stars circling each other and the distance and the center of gravity of the two, you plug it into an equation, and you can actually get masses. And so stars that are close enough that we can use parallax to measure distances, and with the distance we can measure the orbit distances and such, we can figure out mass. But there's one very nice way that someone has figured out to do it as well. Let me drop. Something called gravitational lensing, which again goes back to our old friend Albert Einstein, who believed that gravitational fields bend light, which they do. If you have a known background light and it's coming up against a unknown mass, by figuring out the deflection for that object, you can calculate its mass, and it's been done. They've double-checked it with the parallax equations, and everything seems to check out nicely. So that's another method that they have. Let me drop. I'm concerned, but apparently it's such a variable star that no one has a firm understanding of how far away it is and how bright it is and anything. It's just pulsating, and everyone's just kind of trying to figure out a way to know more about it. Know more about Betelgeuse. Again, contact me for your Nobel Prize. Another thing that I found somewhat fascinating is a lot of astronomical spectrometers complain that as they get older, they lose the ability to see in the violet range, which I guess is important for a spectrometer reader, you know. Anyone with any kind of guesses, as you get older, you seem to lose the ability to pick up violet? I know everyone knows that high-pitched frequencies aren't that well heard of people as they get older, but any guesses of why the heck these poor astronomers can't see violet?
QLR with a comment.
Yes, Kay.
I don't know why they can't see violet, but I do notice when I'm at a star party and I'm showing things through my telescope, children can see the most color. They will think, say, Betelgeuse is a very dark, dark orange. And people in their 20s or 30s think it's an orange. People in their 50s think it's a light orange. And people maybe over 80 think it's a pale yellow. And the older people get, the less color they can see through my telescope consistently. So there is something going on there where you lose the ability to see all colors, at least through a telescope, as you get older.
I guess it's interesting. Again, this is a field of research that hasn't been completed. The reason that's usually given these days is as we get older, we develop mild opacities in our lenses, and also it tends to be this yellowish discoloration that seems to rob us of our violet ability to see violet. They say that this is more pronounced in people over the age of 70, but it would be interesting to do some kind of research into visual color acuity as a function of age, because it's been done a lot with audio, and as a matter of fact, there are applications that kids use in schools, I'm told, that operate on very high frequencies that the children can hear easily and the adults and not hear at all. So, say another interesting field of research for anyone out there. VDH with a comment? VDH.
I notice that when an eye doctor checks you for cataracts, they always use a blue light. I'm wondering if as you age, the blue end of the spectrum sort of gets scattered more by the lens of your eye rather than the red end. Because, as I said, I notice when they check you for cataracts, they always use a blue light. Go ahead. I'm not sure if they're using the blue light specific for the cataract, because just looking at a retinal reflex, you can pretty much see a cataract from across a crowded room. I think the color filters are more to appreciate the background, the retinal changes, that work better with a blue a filter. So it's sort of easy. Once you've seen a cataract, it's kind of an easy thing to see.
I've talked to a number of friends who, because of a cataract, had a lens replacement. After the lens was replaced, they said, "My goodness, am I seeing blue and violet in ways that I never saw before." W. Roy, K2RIW.
Okay.
The
along with the concept that as our lens ages, it yellows and clouds, and even before a cataract, it's a gradual process that's not really obvious unless you're a spectrometer reader, and then you do that for a living, and you're looking at things that you recall seeing back in the old days that you can't appreciate now, and it becomes obvious to them. You know, if we don't see the slight purple in something, we just kind of shrug our shoulders and move on. So I could easily understand why a person with cataract repair suddenly has a much better sense of the color spectrum.
To back up one subject where you're talking about measuring the mass of something by distance and period, one of the universal laws that's simplified rather nicely is that radius cubed is proportional to period squared. If I know the radius between two objects that are rotating around each other, binary system, if I know the distance, and if I cube that distance and then take the square root of the result, I now know the period. So radius cubed is proportional to period squared. That involves satellites around the Earth. It involves things in binary orbit. And I just tried plugging in some numbers where it comes out even. The only place where I know it comes out even, if you change the distance by 4 to 1, 4 to the, I think I did it wrong. I have to double-check that one. But still, that's the radius cubed, period squared. If you want to change the altitude of your orbit of a satellite around the Earth, you'd be amazed how small a change in velocity is required to do that. It's not at all proportional. It obeys that crazy law. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
You know which Kepler's law that might be? I know that they use the third Kepler law, which has more to do with small mass plus big mass, and it's related to a rotation, periodicity, and the radius. But I don't recall one of Kepler's first or second laws.
My first guess is it might be related to equal area swept for equal amount of time. It might be a subset of that one. Go ahead.
So that would be a corollary of his first law, because that was his first thing that he wrote down.
Okay, we repeat right now, first, second, and third Kepler law.
Oh gosh, you're really going to ask me? I don't have them memorized. I believe the first one is what you just mentioned, of how the area that an orbit sweeps is identical over time, and the last one is somehow related to the mass of both bodies along with the radius between the two bodies and the periodicity. I unfortunately didn't scribble them down anyplace.
If we think about it, almost every single NASA mission is a three-body problem or more, three, four, five. So in the case of Apollo, it's a three-body problem between Earth, Moon, and the spacecraft. And when they're flying our spacecraft to other portions of the solar system, You could call it a 3, 4, and 5 body problem because you're sweeping by Mars, you're getting a gravity assist from Jupiter, and so on. So they've been through some very difficult orbital calculations done by some pretty fancy computers. And even though there's no exact solution, I think there's a way they can do it with a computer with what they would call perturbation theory. Not too different from what I did when I halved the distance between bowling ball number 2 and the moon. Well, you don't half the distance. You make a very, very minor change and find out what happens is one possible approach. Over to you, Roy, KQLIW.
Okay, like I always say, Google is our friend. The first Kepler's law is the orbit of every planet is an ellipse with the sun at one of the two foci. The second law is a line joining a planet and the sun sweeps out equal area during equal intervals of time. That's the area.
And what's Kepler's third law?
Third law is the square of the orbital period of the planet is directly proportional to the cube of the semi-major axis of that orbit.
Which I think can be restated as distance cubed equals period is proportional to period squared.
That's how they get it.
So therefore, Kepler's third law is heavily involved in calculating, it's one of the factors used in calculating the mass of objects in space. That's what I think we're saying here, Roy, go ahead.
It's very important, but you have to marry it to Newton's law of gravitational forces in order for you to be able to figure out exactly what the two masses are. You get the sum of the mass of the two bodies, but you don't get the individual without Newton. Figured out that hot activity is associated with very, very, very strong magnetic fields?
There was a dropout of at least one word there, Roy, so please repeat that statement.
Okay, I was wondering if anyone knew how we know that sunspot activity is associated with rather strong magnetic fields.
I think by way of the Zeeman effect, in other words, looking at polarization of the light being emitted, I think you get a very strong clue of local magnetic fields. That's a guess on my part there, Roy. Go ahead.
Well, you guess absolutely right, Dick. It's the Zeeman effect. I don't think it's polarization effect. I think it's more associated with a split in spectral lines. So it goes back to the talk I gave about astronomical spectroscopy. The one of the lines is due to an energy level being raised and lowered of orbitals that are equally potential. A strong magnetic field splits the equal energy level of those orbitals and splits the spectral line. Matter of fact, they can sort of calculate the approximate level of the magnetic field, and they believe that the sun usually has a magnetic field of approximately 1 tesla. During sunspot activity, Zeeman effect suggests that it can go as high as 10 tesla, which is a lot of teslas.
I believe an MRI machine runs in the vicinity of 1.5 or 2 tesla. That's a superconducting magnet and a real strong magnetic field. Obvious by the fact that if a oxygen bottle or a nitrogen bottle got sucked into that MRI machine, it's a significant event which could be life-threatening. And I think there are super strong MRI machines that go up to 4 or 5 tesla. So for something as big as the sun, having that much steady-state magnetic field is significant. I know when I was using a magnetometer 20 years ago, I would measure 450 milligauss for Earth magnetic field. So think that was the number. Over to you, Roy. K2LAW.
It's an incredible number, and, you know, astronomy, if there's one thing astronomy should do for us all is make us feel very, 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 very small. You know, every so often I hear people complain, you know, people have these weird ideas that they'll get rid of nuclear waste by shooting it into the sun, and although I don't, that doesn't strike me as a great idea, because what happens if it doesn't get there? But they're worried that we're going to contaminate the sun. And what I assume is going on is an incredible lack of scale of what they think the sun is in relation to this entire planet.
When the Russians first put up the Sputnik satellite, I think President Eisenhower was then in power, I think. Whoever was in power. We made the mistake of thinking that, they can put up satellites, and they remembered back in the days of early bombing from an aircraft, that when you flew an aircraft over somebody's territory and you stuck a bomb out the window and let go of it, you were bombing their territory. So they assumed that from space that's all you're going to do is put something out the window and let go. Absolutely not. When you're in low Earth orbit, you're moving 17,500 miles an hour in a circumferential velocity. You have to kill a good portion of that velocity in order to make something to go down. So therefore, since the Earth is going around the sun at something like, 18 miles per second, we've got a huge velocity. To make something go into the sun, you have to kill that velocity. It takes a lot of rocket power to do that. So dropping waste products into the sun, I think, is extremely expensive. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
I agree. I mean, it's one of those blue sky things that people think about probably on drugs. Both sides of that problem, you know, give me problems. I mean, the guys who come up with it makes no particular economic sense, but the guys worried that we're somehow going to pollute the sun and it'll turn radioactive on us kind of leaves me with the impression that they don't know what that big orange thing is. You could drop the Earth into it and it would burn.
Power into the sun. And it makes a momentary flare. As far as the big sun operation is concerned, it's a minor event.
Yeah, again, the very aspect of astronomy that I kind of love is every time you look at something, there's something bigger. You know, okay, there's a continent. Well, then there's a planet. Well, then there's a solar system. Well, then there's a galaxy. Then there's a galactic cluster. Then there's a supergalactic cluster. And it just gets bigger and bigger, and still, most of space is empty space. So you can imagine what space must look like, especially if you're assuming that it's infinite. Infinite is a really big space.
When you look at a picture of a galaxy, and you're looking at 100 billion individual stars in this pinwheel-like thing with spokes to it, curved spokes, it looks like a massive object. It is, with a lot of stuff. And yes, there's a lot of stuff. And so it's got 100 billion solar masses on average as its total mass. Once in a while, two galaxies will collide with each other. The spacing between all of those 100 billion stars is so great that when one galaxy collides with another, almost none of those suns collide. They sweep past each other with those empty spaces. The gravity field of each galaxy distorts the shape of the other galaxy. But that shape distortion is because of a gravity phenomena, not because of collisions. There are almost no collisions when one folds through the other. It gives you a strong indication of how much empty space there is. 4.5 light years between us and the nearest star. That's a lot of empty space. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
and it even works if you go in the exact opposite direction. If you take a look at an atom, and please don't take a look at the Bohr atom, because the Bohr atom is a very simplified model that has no relationship with reality. But one of the many problems with the Bohr atom is if it was drawn to it would surprise most people in that it is pretty much, an atom is about 99.999999999% empty space.
The best example I can think of that one, Roy, is if you take a hydrogen atom, or it's a helium atom. If you take a helium atom and build it to scale, where the outer ring of its two electrons, make that as big as Wembley Stadium in London, which is something like a kilometer in circumference. Wembley Stadium is really big. You make that the size of the orbit of the electrons, so to speak. The nucleus would be the size of a, I think it's something the size of a marble in the middle of the stadium. That's the size of the nucleus by comparison to the size of the electrons. That nucleus is an extremely hard, extremely small object with a tremendous amount of empty space around it. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's sort of amazing that the Hadron Collider can actually hit anything. It goes to show how many particles it has to throw together to get any kind of decent interaction, because most of the time they're just kind of skirting around everything. So, you know, scale is very important, and most people either never know it, or even if they're told it, they tend to forget it over time. They'll think that for some odd reason they'll think that the sun is closer than it is, that it's smaller than it is. I guess because all of these models have to show things like that, otherwise you can't appreciate the objects in the model. They'd be little dots someplace. So we're always exposed to these distorted scale models that confuse the heck out of us.
One of the biggest errors in every book that we've ever seen, and they show the solar system, they give you an indication of the size of the sun, they give you an indication of the placements of Mercury, Venus, Mars, Earth, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Saturn, Jupiter, Neptune, so on. The spacings they show are absolutely way, way short, and the size of the planets are way, way short. If you had a reasonable sized sun on the page, you wouldn't get a single planet on the page, and the planets would be so small that there would be only one pixel. You wouldn't recognize them. So every picture we've ever seen of the solar system is way out of scale, and it's given us an extremely poor feeling for what are the scales really like. Okay, Roy, K2RIW.
K2GS. Yes, but I, in that particular case, I could sort of understand, because simply, how would you possibly draw it? You would have to draw it with broken frames, where you explain that it's, you know, 5 million miles between this little crack here and this little crack there, and then scribble things that, okay, we're magnifying the scale effectfold here. So the illustration that you gave people would probably confuse them a lot more than just the distorted one and someone tapping them on the shoulder and saying, of course, this was not drawn to scale. But they never really talk about the scale, unfortunately.
WS2N.
I'm willing to accept the diagram out of scale if every one of those diagrams has a sentence underneath saying that this is 100 to 1 out of scale. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I doubled earlier. I was trying to get back to you when you were talking about sending nuclear debris into the sun. Just to give you an idea, you know, we have a launch coming up in August. We talked about it here on the net, the Parker solar telescope that's going to go it's going to wind up less than 4 million miles from the surface of the sun by the time it gets there. You know, so, I mean, it's almost like hitting the sun. But to get that probe that close to the sun, it has to slow down. Like you said, to slow something down from a speed, right now we're going around the Earth at 66,000 miles per hour, I think you said it's 18 miles per second. To slow that down, this thing has, this spacecraft, this is only like 1,500-pound spacecraft, has got to pass Venus and use Venus to slow itself down seven times. It's going to take like, I don't know, 5 years or so to slow this thing down enough to even get to the sun. So it's, imagine doing that, like, with all the nuclear waste, tens of thousands of tons of stuff trying to do that. It's being launched on, let me drop it. Launched on our largest vehicle that NASA has, the Delta IV Heavy. That's, you know, I mean, it's just a tremendous, that's the heaviest one that we have in the United States that's operational right now. Yeah, the Falcon 9 Heavy is going to be more powerful, but still right now, that's the heaviest one that we have. And it's still not going to slow it down enough. They need to pass Venus seven times. Back to you, Dick.
Another way of looking at it is that every object on Earth, every object around the Earth as a satellite, is part of a system that's moving around the sun at, I think you said, 68,000 miles an hour, or something like 19 miles a second. All of those objects have a tremendous amount of kinetic energy of their velocity, their mass and their velocity. You've got to kill a big percentage of that kinetic energy of velocity in order to move that object into a smaller orbit, like down to Venus, down to Mercury, and inside of Mercury's orbit where that satellite's about to go. It's hard to believe that going down requires so much delta velocity to do it. Over to you, Roy. Take your eyes, everybody.
I think anyone that's ever watched an episode of Star Trek has seen, you know, the maneuver where they kind of spin around and out. And that's what happens if your velocity is too fast. You don't get captured in the orbiting body. You get ricocheted off of it. You get spun around it. So, yeah, you got to slow down to get some places sometimes. It's counterintuitive, like a lot of scientific things. But if you think about it long enough and hard enough and it doesn't give you too bad a headache, then you figure out what's going on there.
Yeah, when Voyager, for instance, flew by a number of planets, I think they flew by Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, in order to pick up velocity by doing a slingshot effect, by flying near the satellite, near the planet on the right-hand side. That gave you a gravity assist. If you fly by the planet on the left-hand side, you can use it for slowing down. So there's a whole lot of these slowing down maneuvers required for this satellite that's going to go near the sun. It's going to fly by the left-hand side of Venus seven times around in a row to slow down a little bit on each one of those. Was that made clear that they're flying on the left side of Venus on all of those slow-down missions, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW.
Oh, I didn't see the diagram on it, but I know it is. They did a similar thing with the Helios spacecraft. There were two of them all back in the, I guess, late 70s, early 80s. And they did a similar type of thing. They're not as close as this one's going to go. But when it went past the sun, it was still moving. Those Helios spacecraft were traveling 150,000 miles an hour in relationship to the sun. To this day, they're the fastest spacecraft that we've ever gotten moving. Let me put it that way. They didn't start out that way. They started off from a launch pad on Earth, but by the time they got to the sun, they were slowing down, and they were still going 150,000 miles an hour by the time they passed the sun.
I think you've told us once before, what is the fastest miles per hour that any man-made object has ever moved? And now you've got a problem with reference to what, as Roy would say. It's all relative. With reference to the Earth, with reference to the solar system, what's the fastest object that mankind has ever launched that you know of, Paul? WS2N, K2IW.
Well, that would have been the Helios spacecraft, one that I just mentioned, 150,000, I think, miles per hour in relationship to the surface of the sun. Going out to Jupiter just recently with Juno, that is now in a polar orbit, and that was 134,000, I'll have to check, but that number seems to bring about 134,000 miles per hour in relationship to Jupiter. By the way, you could also change your trajectory with these gravity maneuvers. You know, for instance, we had a Ulysses spacecraft to go, that thing went over the northern part and the southern part of the sun, but to get there, it had to go out to Jupiter. It went out to Jupiter, it went on to the, you know, to the south pole of Jupiter, and change its trajectory, you know, from the ecliptic to a north-south, you know, a polar orbit. Back to that.
You got it right.
Okay, I mean, we can bring up a short topic, or we could move on to the space report. It's up to you.
If there's no objection, I'm going to mention a couple of things that Paul would like to know with reference to the March issue 2018 of Scientific American. Beautiful article on the subject of Shadows of Other Worlds, the name of the article. It's really the search for exoplanets and the search for life elsewhere. And the article describes a number of satellites that are either being launched or being created right now. TESS, T-E-S-S, which Paul has told us about. I have the acronym here. CHEOPS, C-H-E-O-P-S. Speculos, S-T-E-C-U-L-O-O-S. These are the acronyms. James Webb. James Webb, by the way, is only good for... it's a $10 billion spacecraft scheduled for launch in 2019. It's only good for a planned lifetime of 5 to 10 years because it's going to run out of the fuel required to keep it at that Lagrange point. So as beautiful as that thing is, it's going to be somewhat limited. Other spacecraft are Finesse, F-I-N-E-S-S-E, Ariel, A-R-I-E-L, Plato, TESS. An awful lot of satellites, all oriented toward exoplanet search and search for life. Boy, there's a lot of that going on. And what's amazing is that a very small number of years ago, let me drop to it. All the smart people believed that planets going around a star are a once per million event. We used to believe that planets are very rare. All of a sudden, we're discovering that essentially every single star has planets, and in most cases, multiple planets. So stars went from a million to one. We've changed by, let me pick a number, 3 million to 1 is the ratio of the number of planets we used to believe in about a decade or two ago compared to what we've now got hard evidence for. I think we've got hard evidence for roughly 3,000 exoplanets right now. Newsday also had an article a day or two ago about the two Russian astronauts, Alexander Mishurkin and Mark Zandi, as well as NASA astronaut Joe Akaba, who just returned from the International Space Station. You've got a lot of stuff to talk about here, Paul. WS2NK2RIW with Space Report number 290, I think it is. Yes, you got it, Paul.
Okay, yeah, that was Expedition 54 that just came back. Mark Vandehei, that's how it's pronounced. I know that because we researched him. He was supposed to be the astronaut that was going to be up there. My daughter's school was going to be contacting the space station, but they made a change. You know, they changed the flight crews. They switched them around, and we wound up with Jack Fisher. And they were both great, but we wound up with Jack. He was just terrific with the kids. But yeah, Mark Benhai, KG5GNP, and Joe Akaba, KE5DAR. Notice they all have fives. They all get licensed pretty much in Texas, and that's why they wind up with the five calls. And both those guys in their previous life were teachers. So they were very good, along with Alexander Muskirkin was the pilot, the commander of the Soyuz. Got to see them land on NASA TV. Very cold, cloudy day, 32 degrees on the ground. They had some snow, quite a bit of snow on the ground in Kazakhstan. That's where they land. And usually you get to see the parachute coming down for 10, 15 minutes. You got none of that. They do have pictures now that were taken by planes that were up there. But we didn't get any live shots like we normally do. They landed upright, and they were able to take the crew out the proper way. They like to have the spacecraft land upright. But sometimes the parachutes pull it over, and if that happens, then they can get out on the side door, side hatch. But they prefer the upper hatch. They put this slide and ladders arrangement around the spacecraft. They climb up there, open the door, and pull out the astronauts one by one. So right now we're left with three people on board. We're left with Scott Tingle as the only American astronaut up on board. He's a ham too. KG5, another five, say NNZA. He's up there, and with Rick. And then with one Russian and Norshiga Kanai from the Japanese space agency. So they're up there, and then they're going to be joined in a couple of weeks on March 21st when another Soyuz rocket launches from Kazakhstan, from Baikonur Cosmodrome. Ricky Arnold and he's another ham, KE5DAU. And Drew Fusel, he's, I don't have a call letter for him, so he might not be a ham, along with another Russian. So they'll be going up in March and bring the crew back to six. Now, I'm looking forward to see what happens in November and December with crew launches from the United States. NASA put it up on their manifest. You can get different launch schedules, from around the world, from different places. But NASA does have their own, whatever they're launching, whether it's a robotic mission to Mars or people to space. And on their website, I was surprised to see that they did list two crewed flights for this year now. Last I heard it was going to be delayed to 2019, and I still think it might be delayed, but I'm not sure why they put it up. But they put up the November flight for the Boeing Starliner spacecraft that's being built. Boeing is out there for many years, and they're going to launch it on top of an Atlas V rocket with two solid boosters on it, and an upgraded second stage. They call them center stages. Instead of having one engine, they're going to have two engines on the center stage. So I was surprised to see that they have they're going to put two astronauts in the beginning, and scheduled for November. I think that day is going to slip, but then they also have December for the Falcon 9 Dragon crewed vehicle that they plan on launching also with Crew too. So you can actually see that on their website. And last I heard, they were getting a little bit behind in schedule. I think both are going to be delayed to 2019. I think you're going to see two uncrewed missions from the same, you know, the same star liner from Boeing, and then Dragon for the SpaceX. But I think they're going to go up unmanned. I think you might see that this year. But I hope so, because that will start. You know, that will be the first time that we send astronauts from American soil instead of way back in 2011 when Atlantis flew the last shuttle. So that should be good. Other good launches coming up, like you mentioned a whole bunch, Dick, but I'm looking forward to the InSight mission. InSight mission is going to Mars. That'll be launched in May, this coming May, a couple of months from now. So like I said, everything's an acronym. InSight is Interior Exploration Using Seismic Investigation, Geodesy, and Transport. So basically, they're sending up a seismograph and a heat sensor to check out what the inside of Mars is like. The heat sensor is interesting. They have a drill that's going to drill 15 feet into the ground. That I have to see. I've seen the design. I've seen what they're trying to do. But, you know, if they hit something solid, I think they're going to be in trouble. But they think they're going to go down 15 feet into the ground. And as it goes down, it's going to pull a probe with it, which is really nothing but a thermocouple. And they're going to be able to have an exact temperature deep inside the surface of Mars, 15 feet down, instead of on the surface. They're looking for that information, and they're looking for seismic information as well, by having a seismograph up there. They'll be able to tell what the interior of Mars is more or less like, how far the mantle goes down. Is there some kind of a liquid core that might be left? They think there still is. To figure that out, they have this. They have this seismometer, and it's sitting on the deck of the InSight spacecraft. And they have a robotic arm. The robotic arm is going to grab this sphere, it's about the size of a football. And they're going to take it and put it onto the surface of Mars and then back off and just leave it there. And it's supposed to be so accurate that they can tell if an atom has moved, within inside this thing. It's got some kind of super vacuum that took them an extra 2 years to develop. The French were trying to do it for us. They were partners with us. Yes, that's the French space agency. They were developing this seismometer. And no matter what they did, they couldn't hold the vacuum on it. So they gave it to Jet Propulsion Laboratory. They made the whole thing out of titanium. And everything worked out good. They have a perfect vacuum. But because of that delay, they were unable to make the last window going to Mars, which was 2 years ago. Now this one is coming up in 2018. They'll make it by Thanksgiving. I think the day before Thanksgiving they'll be landing on Mars, roughly near the equator, just north of where Curiosity is now. So, looking forward to InSight. It's based on the Phoenix design. If you ever saw the Phoenix that went to Mars in 2007, it's got the bus frame and then these two solar panels that open up like a big fan. It's probably about each diameter is about 8 feet, I guess, in diameter. And that's going to pick up the sun's rays. I think they're going to get around 400 or 500 watts out of it, something like that, to operate the spacecraft. So, looking forward to InSight. GOES satellite went off last week. GOES satellite was launched from Cape Canaveral using an Atlas rocket. Had four solid boosters attached to it. Beautiful flight. There was a cloud in the sky. Got to see that one as well. That was also transmitted on NASA TV because, it's a deal between NASA and NOAA. The GOES satellite is a weather satellite. And they launched one a year and a half ago, and they put it over the East Coast. And officially, it's not operational yet. I think they got another month. They take like 6 and 8 months forever to, sometimes longer, to calibrate these things. And the same thing with this one. This one's going to go over the Pacific. You know, it'll look at Hawaii, California, all the way down to South America. So, beautiful HD pictures that come back. If you ever see the pictures, I have a before and after the old GOES satellite compared to the new one that's up there now. And there's a big difference when you're looking at a hurricane, any kind of a storm. They're able to monitor the lightning, how many lightning strikes. They also have an antenna on that sticks out to some kind of plasma type of antenna, which is picking up rays from the sun. That's new for the GOES satellite, too. These are like $500 million projects, each one that goes up. Tremendous amount of money on these satellites. So they're very happy when they successfully get to orbit. And there's going to be two more that will be built, I think, 2 years from now. Another one's going to be launched, and then another one after that. So that was successful, and it was a good-looking launch to watch that go up. Nobody does it like that when you watch these things. Jet Propulsion Laboratories has been building a lot of stuff over the years, and they're still very active. And that one I was talking about before, InSight, they were really involved with that, as well as a lot of the other satellites that land on Mars. Now in orbit around Jupiter. So I always say NASA, but Jet Propulsion Laboratory is really involved in quite a bit of this. The James Webb Space Telescope, you were reading about it in a magazine, by the way, I gotta get that March issue. They said now that might be delayed even further. They've got some kind of problem. So, not only that, they're really starting to go over budget. It was supposed to be capped at $8 billion. That was about 3 or 4 years ago. And then it went up to $9 billion. And I think you said it's getting up to $10 billion. And they had some issues. They were doing some testing, and some things didn't come out right when they were, they got to look into something to do with the focus, or I think when they did cryogenic tests, they came up with some kind of questions about that. You know, things change in the cryogenic atmosphere. So they do tests at the same time. And there's something that they want to look at. But the bigger problem that they're having is the sunshade that opens up. It's supposed to be as big as a tennis court. Last time they tried it, it got kind of hung up. And that's the last thing they need, is to have this sunshade that's 5 layers thick, as big as a tennis court, to get hung up when you can't service this thing. This thing is going out to L2 position like we were talking about before, and it's not serviceable. So that's the story on James Webb. I think it might go 2020. Instead of, it was supposed to go 2018. We've been talking about that for years on the net, and then recently 2019, a couple months ago, and now I just read possibly 2020. So that could be a problem. And that's pretty much it. SpaceX is getting ready to make their final iteration of the Falcon 9 rocket. They call it Block 5. There's been a Block 1, 2, 3, and 4, and it's going to be Block 5, different final version. It looks a little different. It's got a different color interstage up near the top. got very dark black landing legs, heavy, more heavy duty landing legs that are going to be able to not only unfold like they normally do, but they're going to be able to fold back up, and they won't have to completely take them off like they do now. It's going to be complete thermal coverage on the whole body of the booster, so it doesn't heat up as much when it comes through the atmosphere. You know, these are all reusable. And it's got a thermal cover, like a heat shield on the bottom, right above the engine, to protect all the piping, wiring, sensors that's directly above that. That's new. And because of all these changes, they expect to be able to launch this 10 times. The last one, it would launch once, and then it would reuse it once. They expect to get 10 uses out of it, and then refurbish it and do it again, and they over and over again, up to 100 different launches. And that should be ready to go maybe the end of March, or maybe April will be the first launch of the Block 5 version. And that will be the one that will launch people. All these other Falcon 9s was designed to possibly do that, but since time has gone by and they've got this latest version with the impellers, the pumps that pump the fluid, they were starting to develop cracks in the earlier versions. This one, they've perfected that way. They won't have that problem in the future. Last thing you need is a crack there. A turbo pump when it's spinning up 100,000 RPM. So that's pretty much it, Vic. I'll turn it back to Nat for any questions, comments. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine. Well, we'll see if we have anybody with any further questions. I'm looking at further this article in the March issue of Scientific American, trying to find out what some of these acronyms stand for. One of the satellites being prepared by the European Space Agency is called Plato. Yeah. It will have 24 telescopes on board. It will scan the sky and be able to look at a very much larger number of stars simultaneously, looking for exoplanets, somewhat like the Kepler spacecraft did. And some of these acronyms are really, really wild. I'm going to read a couple of them for you. Stand by.
They say Plato was funded yet. I remember reading about that about a year ago. Is that funded?
I don't think it's funded yet. I think it's a further ahead plan. But you know about Plato and those 24 telescopes that'll scan a whole lot of sky all at once. So it possibly will find a exoplanets at a rate much faster than Kepler did. The remote sensing, atmospheric remote sensing, infrared explorer large survey, that's Ariel, A-R-I-E-L. Exoplanet spectroscopy survey explorer, FINESSE, F-I-N-E-S-S-E. Fast infrared exoplanet spectroscopy survey. They want to do more than just find planets. They want to find out, do these planets contain an oxygen atmosphere? It turns out that the animals on Earth create oxygen, or the living objects create oxygen, that if all the living objects on planet Earth disappeared, that the oxygen in our atmosphere would go down completely in a large number of years, but it would disappear. So by spectroscopy techniques, by what I call, let me drop it, I call it the extraction spectroscopy. You look at the spectrum coming out of the star. When the planet is eclipsing the star, it's sucking out a small amount of the spectral lines. In other words, the atmosphere of the planet creates some spectral lines of the solar illumination filtering through that atmosphere. You look at the change in those spectral lines and say, aha, I'm seeing an atmosphere that's got oxygen in it. And so we're looking more now for life processes more than just finding planets. and by scanning a much larger group of patch of sky, Kepler did an extremely fine scan of something like 100 or 150,000 stars in one tiny little chunk of sky that's not much bigger than what you'd see through a straw. By things like Plato with 24 telescopes on board, in theory they could look at 24 times as much stuff simultaneously as Kepler did. And with these spectral techniques, looking for life, it's going to get interesting. Over to you for comments on any of this, Paul, WS2N. You're going to like this article. Nicely illustrated, by the way, K2LIW.
Yeah, I used to get that magazine. I used to get a subscription to that, but eventually I dropped it. And now, you know, I'll have to go look for that in the store before they sell out. A lot of times I get to read these magazines when I go to the doctor's office. Some of the doctors I go to have these type of magazines. Most of them have, you know, fashion and this and that, and food, and what your house should look like. But a couple of them have good magazines. And I don't know, when I was younger, growing up, I went to one dermatologist. He always had a copy of QST there. Needless to say, he was a ham. No other comments on that. I talking about the spectroscope, the Hubble and Spitzer, just last week, I have it on my list, but I didn't bring it up there. They discovered water around this one planet, 700 light years away. They show water in the atmosphere, doing what you just said, using the spectroscopes on Hubble and on Spitzer. And Spitzer is another space telescope, and they confirmed that, and it's got a lot of water, and it's about the size of that, this particular planet. Back to you.
The article did mention the great breakthroughs that are likely to be made by James Webb. The fact that James Webb was originally going to be launched in 2017 and now it's being delayed multiple times, I'm willing to tolerate those delays. I think it's much more important that they get it right than get it fast. You know, when it comes to scientific projects, you can make it good, fast, or cheap. Choose any two. If it's good and fast, it ain't going to be cheap, and so on. So, due to the fact that they're sending it out to a Lagrange point, 1 million miles away from the Earth, on the back side of the moon, so to speak, where there's absolutely no chance of a recovery mission if anything goes wrong. You're certainly not going to send astronauts out there. And the degree of difficulty of sending a remotely controlled repair vehicle out there is so high. You've got to get it right. I mean, you can put $10 billion down the tube, so to speak, if you don't get it right. So I'm willing to have them check and double check a zillion times to get it right, because the amount of ways that James Webb Space Telescope has to unfold itself from that launch vehicle, let me drop it. There must be 100 different squibs that have to fire at just the right time to unfold all those things just right. And a whole bunch of motors have to be turned on and so on for everything to align itself. And that mirror, there's individual motors on the individual panels of the mirror that have to align themselves. The number of things that have to go right is so high that you've got to go slow. You've got to make sure that you're double damn sure, belt and suspenders in that operation. Because it's got a huge potential, but the degree of difficulty has never been higher. In the old days, when something was this difficult, you built two of them. Like in the case of the first spacecraft that landed on Mars to look for life, there was two of them. And lucky for us, both of them worked, with Carl Sagan behind that operation, so to speak. But now we can't afford to build two of them. We got all of our eggs in one very expensive basket, which is being shipped very far away. So I wonder if you're as worried as I am on this report. This is a difficult mission. And I wouldn't blame NASA very much if they did all they possibly can and still they get a failure. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, in the old days, they built two of everything, you know. In case one don't work, we got the other one. And it's funny, most of them always work, you know, when they did build two. And maybe that's the reason they stopped after that, you know.